Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Earth Day will be celebrated this coming Thursday, April 22nd. Inaugurated in 1970 in response to growing public concern over corporate-caused environmental pollution, Earth Day was designed to both celebrate and support initiatives to clean up our environment. But lots has happened in the 51 years since. The annual celebration has been thoroughly greenwashed by some of the very same corporations that Earth Day has targeted as bad actors. We face a looming catastrophe in the form of global warming, and we've made not nearly enough progress in limiting greenhouse gas emissions. Today on The Old Mole, in recognition of Earth Day, we're going to examine some of the more promising initiatives to help combat the threat of climate catastrophe. Moles Lori Mercier and Joe Clement will be discussing the movement for degrowth, a necessary challenge to the uncontrolled and relentless expansion that is part and parcel of capitalism. I will be talking with activists Anissa Pemberton and Adriana Vos-Andre about how the Portland Clean Energy Fund has changed the climate justice organizing landscape in Oregon in exciting ways. Bill Resnick will lead off our show talking with Kelly Sanders about LA's proposal to get to 100% renewable energy by 2045. One tiny way you can help create a better and more just world would be to support your very own community radio station, KBOO. We are now in our spring membership drive, and we look to you, our listeners, to do what it takes to keep us on the air. Please, if you can, donate today. You can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You can text KBOO to 44321, or you can send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. As always, KBOO staff and volunteers are grateful for your support. Kelly Sanders is one of the principal investigators of LA 100, the Los Angeles 100% Renewable Energy Study. This integrated engineering and economic analysis underlies LA's goal of transitioning to 100% renewable energy by 2045. Here, Bill talks with Kelly about the vision of our energy future represented in the study and the choices that will need to be made.
Hi, Kelly Sanders. Welcome to KBOO.
It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Kelly Sanders does research in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Southern California, well known in football circles as USC. It's in downtown Los Angeles. Her specialties include water and energy, both of our systems in this country now in crisis, and needing a rapid change to say the least. She was one of the principal investigators and reporters of a study by the National Renewable Energy Lab titled LA 100, the Los Angeles 100% Renewable Energy Study. It describes itself as, I quote, the most comprehensive, detailed study to model an entirely renewable-based power system as complex as LA's. LA is one of some 46 long-established and very successful public agencies in California, including also in Sacramento and San Francisco, and they serve a little over 25% of California customers. In Los Angeles, the public utility is lodged in the LA Department of Power and Water. This is by far the best-known public utility on the planet because its early efforts inspired the movie Chinatown and a whole lot of books. Like the other public utilities, DPW, Department of Power and Water, run some of their own generation plants, some in fact still running coal. They also buy electricity on national market, mostly in long-term contracts, and they own and manage all the electric substations and lines in the city of Los Angeles. In addition to that, over the last 10 years or so, public agencies in California, cities and counties, pursuant to a very favorable state law, they've taken over the responsibility to supply electric power into their area. In fact, today, therefore, over 50% of California electricity customers are served by public agencies. Now the DPW, and near all of them across California, they've embarked on reconstructing their energy system towards all renewable. And to reduce the capital costs of setting up a mostly new system, Kelly Sanders, after that long introduction, tell us about what Los Angeles and the DPW may well do to implement the plan that you and other scientists and engineers have developed.
Yeah, so just to give you a little bit of background on the charge of this plan, California has pretty aggressive renewable energy goals. So a few years ago, we passed what was called Senate Bill 100, and this requires that 100% of electricity sales be renewable or zero carbon by 2045. And so as a response to that, the city of Los Angeles, in conjunction with the Los Angeles Department of Water Power, its municipal utility, commissioned a study. So this was done, as you said, by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and a few academics like myself. And so this represents the work of dozens and dozens of analysts and modelers and technical people and policy people, basically trying to ask the question, how does Los Angeles get to that target of 100% renewable energy? So what this plan basically does is it puts together a few scenarios. Some of the scenarios are indeed 100% renewable. Some of the scenarios allow us to have a little bit of natural gas generation. Some scenarios allow us to have biofuels. Other scenarios don't allow us to have biofuels. So the basic concept is we put together all of these scenarios just to see what the trade-offs would be for the city of Los Angeles if it took path A versus path B versus path C. So we looked really heavily at the technical challenges of the project. So how do you balance a grid that is very high in terms of its penetration of intermittent solar and wind resources? But we also looked at the air emission benefits that would be incurred to the city and where those air pollution benefits might be, for example. We also looked at some of the job ramifications of this bill. Would it cost jobs or would it cause a net amount of jobs to be created? And then the general overall economics of the plan. So I was more on the technical side. So I looked a lot at the electricity system, how this might get implemented, and also the impacts on the water system, because as your listeners might know, here in the city of Los Angeles, we currently get 90% of our water from faraway places, Northern California and the Colorado River. So importing that water comes at the expense of a lot of energy. It also has some vulnerabilities if we were to ever have a big earthquake. So as a reaction to that, the same Department of Water and Power also has a very aggressive water sustainability plan that needed to be integrated with this energy sustainability plan. So I worked a lot on kind of the coordination of those two sectors and what that might look like over the long term.
I think most of us are interested in cities and population centers all over, not just the United States. We could build the kind of culture of energy conservation and use reduction that would limit the time necessary to build out this system and also limit the amount of capital costs and the amount of resources that are required to completely reconstruct an energy system using sun and wind and various other sources. What's your view of that possibility?
you really identified one of the key and central questions to what this renewable energy transition looks like. On one hand, you have this distributed model, which you describe, where a home might have solar panels on its roof and an electric car that uses the solar panel, you know, to charge. And that electric car also becomes storage so that it can store energy when the sun isn't available, for example. You also have things like hydrogen resources. So you can use electrolysis technology, you know, basically split a water molecule with wind and solar and create hydrogen, which is another form of storage. So one of the challenges, of course, with wind and solar that we haven't had with some of our more conventional power plants is the fact that these plants aren't inherently dispatchable. So with a coal plant or a nuclear power plant, of course, you can turn it on and off. With the wind and the sun, it becomes a little bit more difficult to balance. So in this particular study, we did look a lot at the overall potential for rooftop solar. So building out this solar system that you're talking about on rooftops was a really central element of it. And we did a very detailed analysis at National Renewable Energy Laboratory of how much roof space there is, et cetera, et cetera. So the distributed part of this equation, as you alluded to, is critical. If because nothing else, it also engages the customer in the generation and consumption of these resources. So distributed grids will absolutely be a part of this. And I think they're particularly timely in the West and in California because of the wildfires that we've been experiencing. So here in California, utilities are actually voluntarily shutting down the grid such that customers might not have access to electricity for a few hours, and in the worst case, it's lasted for up to a few days. A more distributed grid where you have wind or you have solar and you have storage would allow customers to stay online, to have access to electricity, even if you have a greater grid outage, whether that outage be because of wildfires or whether that outage be because of a storm or et cetera. So distributed is certainly a big part of the puzzle. One of the tricky things about distributed solar is it's actually a lot more expensive than utility scale solar. So building out large arrays of solar panels in the desert, for example, is actually much cheaper per unit of electricity generated than putting solar on your house. Some of that is because of reduced construction cost when you're building the array. Some of it is people aren't necessarily very good at cleaning their solar panels, and your solar panels are only as good as they are clean. So there's some maintenance and upkeep issues there that might decrease the efficiency of the solar as well. So I really see it as a dual solution. I think the distributed grid is really, really important, particularly for reliability in a world where we have a lot more extreme events. But I also think that there might be value to building out some of our transmission infrastructure because, like I said before, the wind isn't always blowing and the sun isn't always shining. So what a very, very large regional grid gives us access to is a diversity of renewable resources. So, for example, in the middle of the country, we have gigantic wind resources. But we really don't have enough people there to even be able to utilize all those wind resources. So if you built really long transmission corridors from the middle of the country out to the coast, you could more equitably distribute those resources. The same thing with solar. You know, the sun isn't always shining in Seattle, for example, but it might be shining a lot more in Arizona. So you could kind of leverage some of the geographic diversity to bring renewables to different parts of the country more equitably. Obviously, building out all those transmission lines, it has trade-offs. You know, you have the ecosystem impacts. These renewable installations have been very contentious here in California because of impacts to the desert tortoise population, for example. Any sort of energy infrastructure is going to have environmental impacts. But having a more distributed grid that spans many different corridors also reduces some of the need for batteries. So batteries themselves aren't that sustainable. You know, you still need to mine the resources to develop the batteries. You have to manufacture the batteries. So creating more of a diverse grid also reduces some of the storage that you might need because you can import and export renewables. Basically, the Reader's Digest of that very long answer is it's probably going to be a hybrid solution between a nice local distributed grid where people are generating and consuming their own solar electricity and some of that utility scale renewables where we are moving those resources from where the renewables exist to the big demand centers.
I particularly liked your comments about reliability of local energy because the grid can often be interrupted by many, many, many things. But we don't have to rebuild an entire huge intercontinental grid at enormous expense, environmental including, as you pointed out. It has to go over farmland. It has to go over rivers, forests. Forest fires can put it out. Because I think the vision is not just Tarkic City living on its own. It's a city confederated with all of its adjacent cities and in some ways under the discipline and responsibility of a regional authority that can, in fact, make sure that things are equitable. So there is a lot of national and international sort of cooperation that's necessary. Yet still the city seems to me to be so important. I think in cities you have a much better chance of creating a culture of conservation where people have a stake in reducing energy. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio 90.7 FM Portland. Kelly Sanders teaches in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at USC, the University of Southern California, and she was a principal investigator in a study by the National Renewable Energy Lab. It's titled LA 100, the Los Angeles 100% Renewable Energy Study. We've been talking about the study and plan, and particularly the balance it has to achieve between locally produced energy and bringing electricity from the grid, and the need for an enormous amount of cooperation amongst energy agencies. It seems to me one of the things that we have to do in the next 10 years is to reduce energy use and conserve the energy we have. Does the plan talk about that?
Yes, the consumer's role in this was a big focus point for this study. And as you relayed in your comments, energy conservation is absolutely critical. So we ran a few scenarios, some with limited energy conservation and then more aggressive scenarios where we really tapped energy conservation from a very, very aggressive standpoint to see what might be possible. The other part of that is the consumer's participation in electricity generation and consumption. So historically, we've lived with a grid where, you know, you basically turn on your lights, you use your microwave, you run your dishwasher, whenever you want. You don't really think about the grid conditions in terms of when you use your energy. Moving forward, the customer is going to become a much more proactive part of this equation. So here in California, for example, in the middle of the day, we often have so much solar, we can't even use it. Sometimes we just end up dumping solar energy because we don't have enough demand to utilize those resources. So a solution to that would be if everyone would decide to use their dishwashers, to run their dishwashers at 12 noon or 2 p.m. in the afternoon rather than at 6 p.m. when everyone's coming home and using their electrical appliances, they would actually be contributing to balancing those solar resources. So that's something called demand response. So in the future, customers are going to have financial incentives to try to prompt them to use more electricity when renewables are available and use less electricity when renewables aren't available. So in that case, your customer is actually kind of acting like a battery in some ways because we're aligning our consumption to the availability of wind, to the availability of solar. And that's really going to help in this effort to integrate these high penetrations of intermittent resources. In terms of this idea of this distributed solar that you lay out, the state of California is already trying to promote that vision. So all of our new homes, all of our new single family homes are now mandated to have solar on them. And as you can imagine, it's been a contentious plan and it's been delayed a little bit. But the idea is that every new single family home that's built in California from here on out will have solar on it. So this distributed vision for solar is absolutely critical to California's success with this. But, you know, for cities in particular, distributed solar is likely to be only part of the solution. Los Angeles is really lucky because we are a high solar resource city. But all of that being said, we also have a lot of people here. We have a lot of multifamily buildings. We do have some dense high rises. So you also have to just make sure that you have the actual area to put some of these renewable resources, which tend to be a little less dense than some of their fossil fuel counterparts. It might be a challenge in some cities that are less sunny or that are less windy to do all of this job locally. Conservation will be huge in this. Energy efficiency will be huge in this in terms of bringing our overall energy loads down. But there might be a need for more of a hybrid solution in cases where you can't generate 100% of your renewables locally within a very small footprint, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Kelly Sanders, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
Well, it was a pleasure to speak with you today, Bill. I appreciate the invitation.
That was Bill Resnick speaking with Kelly Sanders about LA's ambitious and science-driven plan to transition to 100% clean energy by 2045. You, our listeners, come to us for music, for talk shows, for discussion of local issues and happenings that matter to you. You tune in to KBOO for a refreshingly different take on the world than anything else on your radio dial. To keep us going, please consider a donation today. You can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You can text KBOO to 44321, or you can send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, and thank you for your support. Next up, Lori Mercier talks with old mole Joe Clement about the argument for degrowth within international environmental and anti-capitalist movements. Degrowth proposes radical wealth distribution by way of a planned scale-down and reorganization of the economy in ways that increase well-being while reducing extraction, exploitation, and waste.
Good morning. This is Lori Mercier with Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're 1 year past the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day, but we don't seem to be any closer to addressing the global ecological crisis facing us. Many are calling for environmentalists to return to Earth Day's roots of anger and activism, facing the crisis with more urgency, not awe and celebration. And more are calling to make fundamental changes to our economic system to not only save the planet, but improve everyone's quality of life. As one of the original organizers of the 1970 Earth Day, Dennis Hayes said, "Our goal is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all human beings and all other creatures. An environment without ugliness, without poverty, without discrimination, without hunger, and without war. Our goal is a decent environment in its deepest and broadest sense." And last year, Greta Thunberg made a prominent statement against the fairy tales of endless economic growth in her speech to the UN Climate Summit.
"People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth."
Capitalism and most everything in our system depends on accelerated growth. But today, Joe and I want to talk about the principles of degrowth and how it is fundamental to efforts to save the planet and also provides exciting possibilities for activists worldwide. So Joe, you've been thinking and reading a lot about degrowth, and in the past have contributed segments to the Old Mole that consider some fundamental reorientations and practices that can help us reimagine an alternative economy. So tell us something about degrowth its origins and what it is?
Well, degrowth is both an old idea in a lot of ways, and then as a term, it goes to the French movement that is called décroissance, which is a term coined by political economist, radical leftist André Gorz. And it's come into prominence since the 1990s as a kind of counter-hegemonic point de capitaine, a new kind of signifier of how to reorder society in a way that is going to persist and is going to mean the end of many kinds of oppression and exploitation around the world, both human and non-human. The concern with growth has been, you know, as old as early capitalism in the 17th and 18th century. And even in Marx's critique of capitalism, there's a recognition of the fundamental tendency towards overproduction in the capitalist system and its need to constantly expand its circuits of production, distribution, and consumption. More recently, in the last 10 or 20 years, there has been a network of scholars and activists who have elevated degrowth in order to try and bring together a variety of issues that require action, especially though to avert runaway climate change and ecological collapse. And this focuses on the degrowth of the economy. And it's kind of twofold. On the one hand, it's attacking the idea of growth of GDP, gross domestic product. And it's also practically pointing out the need to reduce and degrow the economy as a system of material extraction and transformation and pollution and waste production. And it is bringing our attention to how the possibility of feeding everyone and providing for the full spectrum of human needs is already in our hands. And that in order to both avert climate catastrophes and to right the historic wrongs that capitalism has globalized, we need to degrow that economy. And what that practically looks like is eliminating inequalities and distributing wealth as a funding mechanism for transforming the economy itself away from growth and capitalism.
Well, I love that the French term for degrowth is about liberation, about not shrinking, as many of the critics of degrowth have claimed, but more this narrative of freedom. And I'm wondering if, because there have been critics on the left of degrowth, for example, Noam Chomsky claimed that it would be a non-starter just because this term growth has such positive connotations in our culture and our vocabulary. So I'm wondering how you respond to these critics, especially those critics on the left who believe that it's not an effective way for mobilizing people to this new kind of culture and economy of degrowth.
Well, there's the kind of criticism you mentioned coming from Noam Chomsky, but then there are a lot of left economists and eco-modernists who argue that we need to keep growing the economy in order to create the funding base for investment in renewable and environmentally friendly technologies. But what that line of reasoning banks on is that we can continue growing the economy and somewhere down the line invest in these technologies to transform the economy. But if we don't, then we will be locked into runaway climate change and ecological collapse. And the other issue is that if we keep growing the economy, it will be impossible to scale up renewables to meet energy demand. What is needed in addition to scaling up renewables is just a direct curbing of economic activity so as to reduce the demand and make the transition possible. And so we can express the goals of degrowth in terms of abundance. And the argument's been made for over 100 years by Marxists, socialists, people who've wanted to transform the capitalist system, that providing for the full spectrum of human needs is already in our hands. Fear of scarcity, like, is both real in human history, and it's also a historical ideological product of how capitalism has changed our relationship to the natural world and how we get our material subsistence from it. And if we think about it, the capitalist system and the growth imperative behind it are themselves rooted in scarcity and the creation of artificial scarcities through enclosure, through property relations that prevent access to things that we could share and use in ways that don't produce profit, that don't produce sales. And the reality is we live in an abundant world that is held behind a system that creates scarcity, and that degrowth is about dismantling that system and attacking one of its most kind of critical ideological supports, which is that it has to keep expanding or there won't be anything for anyone.
Yeah, Jason Hickel reminds us that that word growth has become a kind of propaganda term. In reality, what's going on is a process of elite accumulation, the commodification of the commons and the appropriation of human labor and natural resources, a process that's quite often colonial in character. And I also really appreciate Jason Hickel's defense of the use of the term degrowth, because it's a way of jarring people in or provoking people into thinking about what it means by the use of the term degrowth, creating this environment where the problematic assumptions about growth can be discussed and debated.
It's important to understand that degrowth is not an abstract argument against growth. It is first situating growth in the history of capitalism as an imperial system that used force and violence to grow its economy by extracting labor and resources first from the peoples of Europe and then from the peoples of the Americas, Asia, and Africa, and Australia. And in that context, making the case for dismantling the growth based economies of the global north, especially stopping the extraction of resources from the global south. So like you brought up earlier, degrowth is making the case for decolonizing the global economy. And it is also making the case that we need to restructure and scale down our economic activities to bring down the amounts of materials and the energy that we are extracting and the pollution that we are causing, not just in terms of the climate, but in terms of a spectrum of material and ecological systems and their boundaries and limits that we are brushing up against, if not surpassed.
Well, let's talk about what degrowth would look like and what it does look like in some instances.
If capitalism is able to spur growth by creating artificial scarcities, the biggest part of what degrowth will look like is making the abundance of social wealth realized for more people.
This will look like a job guarantee that will direct labor from sectors of the economy that we want and need to scale down into vitally needed projects of ecological restoration and providing for universal public services that will allow people to enjoy the benefits of our technological society without having to pay private companies for private products.
This looks like a universal basic income to offset the gaps in a program like that. But it also means looking at the profound waste of the capitalist system, and not just the kind of incidental waste that eco-modernists and some Marxists will assume can be taken care of with efficiency gains, but the kind of waste that is part of the power structure itself. When you look at, for example, the amounts of food that go to spoil and rot every year, we could cut our agricultural system almost in half and still be able to feed everybody. And in light of that, we have to ask ourselves, what is preventing everybody from being fed by the overabundant surpluses that we have, and see to it that while we degrow sectors of the economy, that what is actually available for the people's needs and desires is spread. With the job guarantee, there's also lots of talk about reducing work hours, both as a way to leverage down the output of the economy, but also to spread the work around and to create more time for non-market activities.
For living more slowly and being able to choose to use public transportation without lowering your quality of life, or choosing to cook for yourself rather than eat fast food without losing quality of life. And
more time for, you know, traditionally family, but expansive versions of families, community, civic and political engagement. And it also looks like, more wonkishly, abolishing planned obsolescence, legislating that manufacturers have to produce things in such a way that they can be easily repaired, and just improve like longevity standards,
so that we're not replacing things as much.
When we look at like kind of the social technologies that are available to us for reducing our consumption, rather than just kind of material technologies, libraries will have to be a larger part of how we share in the goods of our system, and socializing ownership and focusing on usership as kind of a consumer orientation to the stuff of the economy will go much further than technological changes to the commodity system we have now at averting climate catastrophes.
These are all great ideas and solutions. And I mean, I think we could keep going in terms of imagining or even plotting out how every aspect of our daily life might change for the better. with these degrowth principles in mind. And I think we can look to some concrete examples, can't we? I mean, I'm immediately thinking about Cuba and how the country reoriented its priorities and focus, for example, to look at health and well-being. So here you have an impoverished island country that has made health and universal healthcare a priority. It has had one of the lowest rates of COVID in the hemisphere. It has one of the lowest infant mortality rates. It actually, because of its prioritizing medical care, has created this incredible infrastructure and even sends its healthcare professionals to other parts of the world that desperately need healthcare. So I think that's an example of how we could reimagine this refocus, moving away from the imperial war industrial complex to projects that really advance the well-being of everybody.
What Jason Hickel points out in his work on degrowth, he wrote a book called The Divide, and then more recently, Less is More, How Degrowth Will Save the Planet, that we have to think of degrowth in a global context. The fact that the Earth is imperiled is not a responsibility shared equally by all humans on the Earth, as is often kind of the trope of denigrating humanity for destroying the Earth or the Anthropocene. It's rather a specific kind of social system that has taken over the Earth in the last several hundred years. And so we need to look at the Global South, not just for the explicitly vanguard socialist projects like in Cuba, but for the fact that across the Global South, when countries were throwing off colonial shackles in the mid-20th century, they were throwing off and called to throw off by different theorists and political leaders of the time, the growth imperatives that colonialism from European capitalist countries brought, and develop economies based around not just subsistence, but in Gandhi's words, permanence, creating self-sufficiency and
well-being.
And getting closer to the land and elevating the relationships of communal human life. And to modernize that, you know, we can look to examples like Cuba, but we can also look to how countries like Costa Rica also invest in healthcare and the population's health. And they don't have high GDPs. They have GDPs that are a fraction of the United States, and yet they have higher health outcomes. And this has to do with just this general ethic of care and stewardship that embody the way that the resources of the economy and all these different countries are shared.
And throughout this post-colonial period, but especially starting in the 1970s when global capital was slowing down again, you had international organizations dominated by former imperial powers like the IMF and World Bank making these structural adjustment loans to former colonized countries to help develop their economies, on the condition that they abandon their well-being economics and promote privatization, free trade, and an economy based in capitalism.
This is Laurie Mercier with Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and we've been talking about degrowth as a movement for opposing capitalism and creating a sustainable and just world.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Stop it squarely on a dime. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library. If I's a book in a library, then I'd finally be free. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library.
That was our very own mole, the talented Joe Clement, with a song he wrote and performed himself. You can hear more of the conversation between Laurie and Joe and find lots of links to materials about the degrowth movement when this show is posted to kboo.fm/oldmole later today. In honor of Earth Day, I would like now to take a closer look at a green initiative in Portland with considerable promise, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF for short. PCEF was a ballot initiative that passed by an overwhelming margin in Portland in 2018. It was designed and promoted by a BIPOC-led coalition of environmental and community justice organizations. The program levies a 1% tax on gross revenues of the largest corporations with sales in Portland, which will generate an estimated $50 million annually to support Green New Deal type projects targeted at low-income and BIPOC communities. PSEF recently made its first grants, which included 45 awards to nonprofit organizations representing various BIPOC and low-income communities for a wide range of projects, including building green infrastructure, sustainable urban agriculture, and green job training programs. PSEF is unique in the country as a citywide Green New Deal and serves as a model for similar initiatives elsewhere. But for those of us in the climate justice activist community, PSEF is not an endpoint. It is rather an important step on the way to a more radical restructuring of our society in order to undo centuries of environmental racism and avert climate disaster. The PSEF campaign was groundbreaking, and not just in getting real benefits into BIPOC and low-income communities, but also in opening up further organizing possibilities. Today on the show, I have two guests with me. Anissa Pemberton is the Portland Clean Energy Fund Coalition Coordinator at the Coalition of Communities of Color. Growing up in rural Illinois, Anissa faced the climate crisis at a young age from the pollution from industrial agriculture and manufacturing in their community. They began working with the Portland Clean Energy Fund as a field organizer in 2018 and began to manage and advocate for the Portland Clean Energy Fund Coalition in 2020. Also with me today is Adriana Vos Andre, who is the co-founder of 350 PDX and a chief petitioner for the Portland Clean Energy Fund ballot initiative. Adriana was literally at the meeting when the idea for a Portland-style Green New Deal initiative was hatched back in 2015. Welcome to the Old Mole, Anissa and Adriana.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for having us.
I would like to start our conversation today by looking back at the campaign and how it unfolded. It was a coalition campaign, which meant that many organizations were involved, coming from a wide variety of experiences and perspectives. But at the very beginning of the campaign, a decision was made to establish the leadership of the BIPOC community within the campaign. How did you make that happen?
Building a diverse, inclusive coalition was actually key to PSEF's ultimate success. It turned out to be crucial not only to the ultimate success of winning the initiative campaign, but also it really helped us further the other central goals of the coalition, which was building the political power of BIPOC and marginalized communities in our city and beyond, and growing a large, inclusive, intersectional movement that was capable of bringing about not just incremental transactional change, but really the necessary transformational change that so that we can really, truly begin to address the root causes of the climate crisis from the bottom up. It's important to note that PSEF wasn't drafted as a climate measure and then had social justice and racial justice tacked on, but rather from the beginning, there were co-equal goals, recognizing that these are related to the root causes of the crisis itself. Paradoxically, due to the shared sense of an extreme urgency around the global climate crisis, it became increasingly clear that we actually needed to slow down to allow time for the relationships to develop and for organizations to be able to really build the staff capacity to participate more genuinely and deeply. We actually met for years before we got close to a public campaign. Building trust was key. And once we built that trust to really, you know, make huge strides and take big risks together, one of the lessons learned here is that it takes really being present, being open to new practices, and to really be willing to explore what it means to center frontline leadership. And again, it's like our steering committee was very intentional about which organizations they subsequently then invited into the core coalition. Each were individually interviewed and were carefully vetted by the coalition's BIPOC leadership
to ensure that they would actually follow and support frontline leadership and were ready to embrace these values.
Did you find in general that that was a challenge for an organization like 350 PDX to engage in those ways?
Well, I think that at the time, you know, we certainly there was a strong desire in leadership of our organization already at the time to center frontline leadership. And we had recognized how important this was to our work, to our movement building work, to our core mission. One of the biggest challenges, I would say, was to slow down, you know, because we're so used to doing things to like moving as fast as we can and to feeling that urgency and so forth. So to take that time to slow down, that time it really takes to build trust, that is a major challenge.
I just wanted to jump in and add one thought. I was talking to an elder who was part of the original group of folks that put this coalition together this morning. And he mentioned to me that there also had to be a lot of truth telling, a lot of naming of how the environmental movement has excluded BIPOC communities in the past and what the history has meant for that. And sometimes that meant individual organizations, but often it was a broader pattern of behavior that is kind of hard to nail down to one organization or one group of people or an individual. It's funny, I worked at 350 PDX coming into the campaign. And I think there was just a little bit of a learning curve, you know? I mean, I think a lot of white folks are new to these conversations. So on the volunteer basis where I mostly worked, I just noticed that people were really excited to do the campaign, but people were also feeling, you know, kind of uncomfortable because they weren't used to this type of organizing.
Let me shift to a slightly different but related topic is the relationships that you built with labor. There's another kind of historic divide between environmental groups and labor groups that you somehow managed to bridge. How did you do that?
First of all, labor unions and groups, you know, although often in solidarity with each other, are each unique in their mission, character, and politics. The focus here, I would, in your question, is I think refers to our relationship with the building trades. And there's a long history here between the building trades and environmental organizations, both here, but also across the nation, really, that there's been a major challenge in forging alliances. And this was sort of exemplified when I and another 350PDX leader at the time, Rick, initially reached out to some of the local building trades leaders very early on. A number of things that we heard is that our groups, 350PDX included, had a very strong mission of opposing new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. In this case, one of the big ones was Jordan Cove. They wanted us to like at least go from opposing to be neutral, which of course, and for them, that was like, dude, this is our number one issue. And for us, it was also our number one issue in the other direction. So like just starting that conversation from, you know, when we've been on the opposite sides, you know, was incredibly challenging. The other points that were brought up, and I've heard this from many others who have been trying to forge these relationships, is that the just transition jobs that environmentalists were kind of trying to bring about were seen more by the building trades as sort of future possibilities that may or may not be realized. Whereas something like Jordan Cove was like shovel ready, that would bring immediate jobs to their membership. And moreover, the fossil fuel infrastructure work were typically union work, whereas the preponderance of jobs in the renewable energy and energy efficiency sectors, including local programs at the time, were not. The initial conversations, they didn't move very much at that point. You know, getting SEIU and AFSCME were relatively easy because there were some relationships, especially between, you know, certain BIPOC and labor leaders. The building trades was a much longer and tougher road. So first of all, the right messenger. So building trades leadership, they actually liked organizations like Verde that built good labor relationships and provided skilled jobs to under-resourced neighborhoods. Secondly, momentum. When they saw that the large piece of coalition that we had built had a serious chance of actually passing the measure, that certainly made a difference as well. Like it was not just some future distant thing. It was actually something that could be real and very soon. The other thing is pressure from their rank and file. They were saying later in reflection that their rank and file, especially millennials and Gen Z, they want to see more. They want to be part of this renewable energy economy. And they're recognizing the sheer number of just even electricians needed for over the next decade for this major transition to happen. The leadership felt sort of some pressure from internally that, like, they couldn't just oppose PSEF when their rank and file was seeing themselves as part of this transformation. The other thing that mattered was that language in the measure had things like they provided wages at rate equal to at least 180% of the state minimum wage. And especially that PSEF would create a pipeline to union apprenticeship by funding pre-apprenticeship training was really, really important to them as well. So they saw that we were taking that we were not only having these conversations, but we were really like incorporating things that were very important to labor, to building trades in particular, into the language.
Part of the explicit aim of the PSEF campaign was not just to pass a ballot initiative, but it was also to build a movement. So I'm interested in how that additional aim of the organization changed your on-the-ground tactics and strategies.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one thing that's helpful to keep in mind is I think when, at least from what elders have told me, when the PSEF coalition got put together, I think we were all thinking about how can we revolutionize the clean energy sector? How can we make this a more inclusive sector? And I think that kind of led to this really broad coalition building over time, you know, where we had to engage a lot of different types of interests. We had over 200 endorsing organizations on our voter pamphlet, which was at the time and may still be the largest amount of endorsing organizations in Oregon's history. Yes, and there was some amazing organizing happening behind the scenes to make that happen. I think from my point of view, once it passed, and this is just as a field organizer, I realized in the moment that we really had something here, that we had something to work with that really represented my interests, that represented the broad swath of interests. I think since the movement has really taken its lessons from the Portland Clean Energy Fund campaign. I've seen it on a statewide level with the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity campaign, the organizing there. While we're in the state legislature, we're still very much trying to decolonize the work we're doing. We're still very much trying to lead with trust first and really work on being transparent and being open. But I really feel like PSEF planted a seed of, wow, we don't have to just be okay with having false solutions or, you know, as Adriana pointed out, these intermittent, very like not systemic solutions. We can actually ask for what we need and we'll get it. And I think that's really the power of PSEF. It really empowered a ton of people in the movement to think broader and to be honest about what they wanted. And I think it also made us trust each other more. And at the end of the day, you can't put a price on that in terms of movement mm-hmm. building. I think relationships are the secret sauce of organizing work. I think without those, we would not be getting half of the things done that we get done.
Going forward, how are you planning to build on the tremendous success that you've had?
The steering committee, it's all the same organizations, but there's a lot of new people at the table, younger people. I'm really excited. There's like a lot of LGBTQ plus people, which really changes the ways that I think we're having certain conversations about things. We decided that we were going to look into some things and we're still looking into them. It's very much in a research phase. But a lot of the organizations are involved in the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity campaign, which I think is a really great way for us to build our own political knowledge and our muscle and work across difference with rural districts, frankly. I think one thing, being from a rural community, that PSEF couldn't address is, you know, rural folks who often have a much higher energy burden. In certain parts of the country, low-income rural folks are paying 15% of their income towards energy costs. So depending on where you live and your financial circumstances, it can be really intense. So we have a healthy homes bill that will help upgrade people's homes and help folks stay safe and healthy in the wildfires and all of this other stuff that's happening every year. And then there's the energy affordability bill as well. And that bill will help set up a low-income ratepayer class at all of the utilities so that if you make under a certain amount of money, your people who make more money kind of supplement what you're going to be paying, which is a great bill. And both of those are bipartisan bills, which is really exciting. I think that's the thing about what's happening in the movement right now is I think we're all getting, in a weird way, more ideological and less attached to what traditionally is seen as like possible. And I can say just personally, I have a lot of conversations with my folks who are both rural Republicans, very conservative, and they always get really excited about the work I'm doing. And I think it's because it's not a regressive tax system. It's not to create more taxes on them. It's really targeting who has the money and where is money concentrated. And that's been our approach in the movement. And I hope that continues to be our approach because I think it's the right one. I think it's really actually getting at what we want. And actually getting at what most people want.
It sounds like PSEF then is getting its fingers into a lot of different areas of organizing. And after breaking down barriers between white activists and BIPOC activists and breaking down barriers between labor and environmentalists, you're now taking on that urban-rural divide, which is really, really important work to be doing. I'm sorry that we're out of time because this is a really interesting conversation, but we'll link on our website to your websites and some of the reports that you've put out. Yeah, Anissa sure. Pemberton and Adriana Vos Andre, thank you so much for joining me today. We'll have to continue the conversation. I feel like we barely scratched the surface.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That wraps up our show for today. Special thanks to our guests, Kelly Sanders, Anissa Pemberton, and Adriana Vos Andre. Thanks also to Moles, Bill Resnick, Joe Clement, Laurie Mercier, and to Denise Morris for her editing assistance. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. No other radio station in Portland is going to talk about the unique and radical nature of climate justice organizing here in Portland, or about degrowth as a necessary strategy for saving our planet, or about how LA is using science to design a clean energy future. But, unlike Earth Day, KBOO does not have corporate sponsors. We depend on you. Please support us by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate, or texting KBOO to 44321, or mailing us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. For those who have already given, KBOO thanks you. I'm going to leave you today with the Beatles' classic ode to planet Earth, Mother Nature's Son. Don't miss KBOO's all-day special on Earth Day this coming Thursday, April 22nd. Until then, stay safe and stay active. Singing song.